Max Erwer, 1901 to 1981. The Professor. Continued.
This week's episode of the New in Chess podcast features a narration from The Essential Sosonko, a collection of chess portraits and personal stories authored by chess grandmaster Genna Sosonko. The subject of this week's story is Dutch former world champion Max Uwe. Max was a big figure in chess, both as a player and as an administrator. At his playing peak, he defeated reigning champion Alekhine in 1935. As president of FIDE, he presided over the famous Fischer-Spassky match of 1972. His involvement in chess on both a competitive and an organizational level make Uwe one of the most accomplished chess figures of all time. Enjoy this week's episode of the New in Chess podcast.
At the end of the 1970s, a committee was formed to assist Jan Timman in his quest for the world championship, of which Erwer became a member. He supported the committee personally, paying considerable sums out of his own pocket, while studiously avoiding getting any credit for it with no noise or folderol. It seems to me that, beside his immediate assistance, he also wanted to continue the tradition of the Erwer Committee, which had secured assistance for him 50 years before and organised the match for the World Championship. They helped me then, now it's my turn to help them. In his view of the world, this was a duty, a key term, I think, for understanding the essence of Erwer, and a proper one in every sense, for Timman, for chess, and for his country. And this last word was no empty phrase to Erwer. His daughters remember that the only time they ever saw their father cry was on May 15, 1940. "We were not yet in school. Our father sat on the chair, being shaved by the barber, who usually came in the morning. The radio was on, and father had just heard that we had surrendered to the Germans." He never went to museums and almost never read. There simply wasn't time. Once he took a few mindless paperbacks with him on holiday, read them quickly, and spent the rest of the time spinning with idleness. He had perfect pitch and loved classical music, Beethoven, Chopin, but he never went to the Concertgebouw, because that would have required time. Music was a background sort of thing for him, something to enjoy while doing something else. Caroline Erwer recalls, "He always went to bed at 10:30 after listening to the late news on the radio. He hated disorder more than anything else in the world. He would plan everything, vacations, free time, and he would make schedules for my mother of what to do and when and how to do it. Everything always had to be in order and in its proper place. He got angry when we brought home poor marks from school, and he'd get angry again when he sat down to work and I played football with the boys under his window." Describing Jan Timman's father, mathematics professor Rein Timman, Erwer wrote, "I have known many professors, but only the rarest of them combined deep professorial knowledge with such outstanding characteristics as objectivity, humility, and modesty." This, of course, was Erwer himself. What was characteristic of him was also what he valued in others: objectivity, modesty, and restraint. The self-absorption and self-castigation common to many chess players were completely alien to him. The first half of the World Championship tournament of 1948, which went poorly for him, took place in The Hague. Returning home to Amsterdam, he usually sat in the back seat of the car with Karel van der Berg, his assistant for this event. Analysing a position on his pocket set, he announced, "I've got to resign, this position is lost," and immediately began talking about other things, as though chess had completely ceased to exist. Smyslov recalls, "Max Erwer was a genial sort, although our games generally did not turn out well for him, and he often suffered from bad luck. I was constantly amazed by his absolutely correct behaviour after the game and during the post-mortem analysis. At Groningen, 1946, Erwer played very well, but Botvinnik was very lucky. He found a draw in the adjourned position of his game against Erwer, even though it seemed to all that he was lost. We had dinner together, and Mikhail Moseyevich spent the whole time analysing the position on his pocket set. He was very nervous. Botvinnik has asserted that there was a time when his relationship with Erva was quite difficult. I find that hard to believe. Erva himself would probably have been surprised to learn of it. He himself had, at any rate, no difficult relationship with Botvinnik. His friend and second, Hans Gmoch, wrote at the time that Erva was never happier than when he could make someone happy. Jan Timman was scarcely 12 when he played his first game against Erva, in a simul given at The Hague in 1963. The game, a stonewall variation of the Dutch defence, developed along interesting lines and eventually ended in a draw. Jan recalls, "I sat next to my older brother Ton, who got an advantage out of the opening and offered a draw. Erva smiled and said, 'No, it will be a while before you will have another chance to play me.' Ton eventually won. Typical Erva, comradely, giving a youngster confidence with a gesture when the outcome of the game was unimportant. It was as if he placed himself in the background." He could speak the major European languages. His strongest point was German, the chess player's international language before World War II. Already getting on in years, he began to take lessons in Spanish. I remember a speech he gave in Spanish at the opening of the Buenos Aires Olympiad in 1978. Russian proved harder for him, although he was a frequent visitor to the Soviet Union and tried hard to learn the language. His knowledge was limited to a few phrases. I heard some of them at the close of the Biel Interzonal in 1976. With the help of these and some cobbled together English and German words, Erva carried on a half-mimed conversation with Geller and Petrosian. But when the latter, overjoyed at the opportunity to converse without their interpreter, exceeded Erva's conversational speed limit, a common error of people who speak only one language, the professor could only exclaim, "Da, da!" and nod pleasantly at whatever was being said. In his younger days, Erva would spend Sundays playing football, boxing and swimming. Els Erva remembers, "My father played table tennis frequently, preferring a defensive strategy. He would often retrieve the hardest hit balls, beating players who were stronger than him. He decided to learn how to fly a plane, and we, his children, would stand bursting with pride when he did loop-de-loops over our house. Fortunately, he failed the final exam, so he never got his pilot's license. Just as well, since he would doubtlessly have been called up, and almost all the pilots got shot down on the first day of the war." When Erva was asked which was the greatest day of his life, he replied, "The day in 1964 when I made professor." These words touched off a furore in the chess community. How could this be? How could a world champion, whose name is known to millions, consider some other unimportant fact to be more significant? A fact, moreover, that appears as only a short one-line entry in any chess encyclopedia. Yet I feel that Erva said what he truly believed. It was not his style to put people on, nor was he an eccentric or unaware of the significance of his achievement. The examples of Newton, who considered the greatest accomplishment of his life to have been his Notes on the Book of the Prophet Daniel, or Wagner, who valued his poetry higher than his music, are inappropriate here. Of course, Erva fully understood that there are thousands of mathematics professors, but only one world chess champion. His statement speaks, first and foremost, of the position he assigned to chess on the scale of human values, a scale whose measures he set himself. This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. DGT introduced digital clocks to the chess world at a time when only analog clocks were used. For over 30 years, DGT has been making the official FIDE chess clock, endorsed by the World Chess Federation. DGT clocks are the world's best-selling chess clocks, the standard in chess timing and used everywhere. To find your nearest DGT dealer, please visit our website at dgt.nl. Lasker's words from the beginning of the century define Irva's relationship to the game and to chess professionalism, and apply directly to his case. And such uncertain professions also include that of the tournament chess player. One can hardly call it a profession in the full sense of that word, inasmuch as it fails to provide a stable income sufficient to support a family. But it does bring fame, and poverty is more easily borne when one considers oneself unique. Fame may also be employed in the business world, where it sometimes gives one the opportunity to choose other employment, such as that of tax agent or teacher, or may give one the possibility of obtaining a recommendation for easy work at an acceptable salary. In the Roman worldview, only civic jobs held the stature of negotium. All other employment was leisure, or otium. In Western Europe in the 1920s and 30s, these two Roman concepts nearly dovetailed with society's distinction between a real profession and that of a chess player. Interestingly, at the same time in the Soviet Union, professionalism in chess, which would become a common occurrence in the latter half of the century, was still quite a novel concept. Misha Botvinnik, then a young student, recalled the bitter pill he had to swallow when he returned to the Polytechnic Institute after his match against Fleur in 1933. All the students had to finish their dissertations except two. One had been sick, and the other had been called away for a social amusement, as the director put it. At that time also, a humorous couplet circulated around the technical school concerning Alexander Kotov, the future grandmaster. It read, "There's no need to be a maestro, but you must become an engineer." The game was popular enough, even in Tsarist Russia. The St. Petersburg tournaments of 1909 and 1914 were significant events. The presence of Lasker, Capablanca, and other leading grandmasters of the age filled the halls with spectators, even though, just as everywhere else in Western Europe, chess in Russia was primarily a game for the higher echelons of society. But there is more than long tradition to explain the great interest in chess in the Soviet Union. "What else is there for them to do?" replied Alyakin, after he emigrated to the West when asked in the 1920s about the reasons for the popularity of chess in the USSR. The isolation of the Soviet Union from the other nations of Europe, the energy of the masses that required an outlet, the support on the very highest level, all these factors gave rise to a phenomenon that lasted for decades, Soviet chess. Chess became a political instrument utilized to show the entire world the superiority of the socialist system. The very first Soviet championship, won by Alyakin, was held in Russia 3 years after the establishment of Soviet rule. In the 1920s and 30s, along with the strongest possible international events, the Soviet Union also held hundreds of events on every level. The strength of the Soviet masters started by matching the level of the strongest Western players and ended by surpassing it. "Chess is the gymnastics of the mind," V.I. Lenin. Thus read the banner that hung in every chess club in the Soviet Union. It did not matter that Lenin, who genuinely loved chess and played it when abroad in exile, never actually spoke these words. It made an impressive motto and did a lot to popularize the game in the Soviet state. "Chess is no way inferior to playing the violin," affirmed Mikhail Botvinnik, the acknowledged leader of Soviet chess. Western professionals who played in the Moscow International Tournaments of 1925, 1935 and 1936 called the Soviet Union a chess El Dorado. The crowds of fans, thirsting for a glimpse of the masters playing in the finest halls in Moscow, could hardly be restrained by mounted policemen. The only comparable phenomenon in the West was show business. There, chess players generally stewed in smoky cafes, and the profession of chess player would only elicit a quizzical raising of eyebrows. The actual professionalization of chess in the Soviet Union did not start until after World War II. This saw the emergence of a new breed of young Soviet grandmasters, strong and seasoned professionals whose level of play was so high that in the post-war Olympiads, the team championships of the world, the only question was how many points would separate the Soviet team, in first place, from whoever came second. The result of the Buenos Aires Olympiad in 1978, when the Hungarian team managed to relegate the Soviet team to second place, was considered practically the worst disaster in the entire history of Soviet chess. Meanwhile, the process of professionalization in chess was being taken up by other countries as well. Along with Eastern European teams, the strongest teams in Western Europe and the United States were wholly made up of professional players. Although chess had changed drastically before his eyes, Erva's opinion of chess as a profession remained unchanged right up to the end. Here's what he wrote to his student, Annika Timman, on the occasion of the death of her husband, Jan Timman's father, in 1975. "I approve of Jan's decision to abandon chess as a profession and spend the bulk of his time in future on his university studies, and I am very happy for him and for your whole family. Of course, chess will remain a part of his life, along with his main profession, but he will have a far more serious attitude toward it than he did before. I regard his intention as most laudable. This will be an honourable action, a tribute to his father's memory. I am pleased with his decision. This will be a most fortunate turning point in Jan's career, of which chess shall ever remain a part." It was precisely this attitude toward the game that I believe explains Erva's decision in the early 1950s to give up professional chess for good, more than the aphorism that whatever we cease to succeed at ceases to attract us. The period in which Erva led the life of a chess professional was a difficult one for him. The simultaneous exhibitions, often played in the smoky rooms of some public house, and his material dependence on chess were not only difficult for him psychologically, but also sapped his general sense of well-being. At the time of the tournament in Switzerland, his daughters constantly had to press ice to his temples, and Taimanov remembers how, during the candidates' tournament in 1953, his wife was constantly massaging his head while his opponent was considering his next move. Taimanov said, "At that candidates' tournament in 1953, Erva played no worse than the others, but I think he found playing tougher, more difficult than the others. But he did win from me, even though I was only half his age. The variation of the Nimzo Indian defence we played in our game had been thoroughly analysed by myself and Fleur, or so we thought. Erva refuted this analysis and won an important theoretical dispute."
You love chess? Why don't you try New in Chess? With readers in 116 countries, New in Chess is the premier chess magazine in the world. What will you get? Exciting chess games explained by the best experts in a clear and accessible way. On-the-spot reports of the biggest events. Top-notch instruction. Independent journalism. Chess history that comes to life. And great interviews. New in Chess, the way you want it. The beautifully produced paper edition or the digital edition for phone, tablet or PC. Give it a try. Go to our website newinchess.com/magazine for more information about subscriptions and special offers.
"We only had enough of everything after Father became a professor," recalls Els Erva. "There was money in the house, which pleased him a lot. He would say to my mother, 'Go ahead and buy yourself a fur coat.' He liked telling her that a lot. Once, in the airport, we were in the VIP salon, and he was obviously enjoying being there, just as he enjoyed, at the end of his life, a nice, spacious apartment with lots of room and central heating." This last period of his life coincided with the appearance and further growth of a society of material prosperity and the rejection of conventional values in Western Europe, and above all, in Holland. comparing the serious, concentrated face of Max the schoolboy and student with the often smiling visage in the photographs taken in the latter years of his life, one cannot help thinking that he was born old and wise and grew younger. With age, he became gentler and more expansive, and those close to him knew that behind the facade shown to all, behind the costume of the modest shirt and the severe tie, there lay hidden an emotional man who reacted to the joys and pleasures of life, which he had either failed to notice before or had consciously renounced. He no longer had to tie himself to the mast. Like Odysseus, he had given life more than he had taken from it, and wasn't it time to think of himself at last? In the last year of his life, Elzerva took a cruise with him. Among the books taken along by his daughter, he noticed a brochure on stress and decided to read it. "Elsa," he said, "I don't understand what this is. I have never suffered from stress." On the same occasion, he also said to her, "I see you talking to all kinds of persons here. I wouldn't for the life of me know what to say to all these people." He was accustomed either to speak to or in the presence of many people at once, in front of a class, in the student auditorium, at a FIDE congress, or to open an Olympiad, and each such discussion, appearance or speech had some sort of goal in mind. Who knows whether this constant occupation, these various matters and obligations, this tightly wound spring of a life might be explained by his not knowing what to say when it was just one-on-one with the most difficult conversation partner of all, himself. I'm sure he did not have a very good time on that cruise. The lack of space forced him into activities that were alien to him. More importantly, they lacked all sense or point for him. Conversations at the bar or with his table companion, when the subject of your conversation is forgotten the next minute, changing for dinner. After all, the whole point of a cruise is the cult of food, all possible amusements and diversions, watching the evening show and the short tourist dash ashore whenever the boat puts into harbour, or something more senseless still, watching the clouds roll by and listening to the water lapping against the ship as you lie on a blanket in your chaise longue and do absolutely nothing, nothing at all. I never regarded him as a historical object, and even less as a subject for literature, perhaps because whenever I talked to him about the past, he would quickly steer the conversation back to the present or the immediate future. Erva was first and foremost a man of action, not of philosophy, and whatever he did, he strove to do the best he knew how. The words of the Amsterdam sage Spinoza apply directly to him. The more perfect in its nature something is, the better it works and the less damage it suffers. The reverse is also true. The better something works, the more perfect it is. Erva was not a believer. His wife was very religious, and he probably felt that she was responsible for this aspect of their lives. I recall his widow, while accepting condolences after his cremation, replying with firm assurance, "I do not doubt that I shall see Max again." In his conception of an orderly universe and what was important in the life of a man, the starring role was allotted to time. This was the only god he acknowledged. In his view, the greatest sin in life was the less than optimal utilization of life, which was given only once. One might apply the words of Einstein, "If I knew then I must die in 3 hours' time, it would make no great impression on me. I would try to think about the best way to make use of those 3 hours." You could say the same things about Erva. He worked constantly at his writing desk, at the chessboard, behind the auditorium lectern, while airborne, on the train, even in the carriage that carried him to his own wedding. Rodin's motto, "Toujours travailler," brackets, "you should also work," close brackets, was also his, or perhaps better, Kant's, "work is the best way to enjoy life." The term workaholic would have fitted him perfectly if it had been invented then. Hans Kmok said of him, "Erva can only breathe freely when he is smothered in work." Returning home from abroad, his first order of business, even before taking off his coat, was always to go to his writing desk and sort through his accumulated correspondence. He often replied to letters on the same day and felt very bad when his occasional journeys made this impossible. There can be no doubt that this new age, with its technical possibilities, would have appealed to him very much. Whenever he overcame one barrier in his life, whether it was winning the national championship, attaining the grandmaster title, the world championship, or the professorship, he was always aiming for the next one, believing that what was already achieved was now in the past. When he moved into his new apartment, he took with him not a single clipping or article about his past successes. That was all in the past. I don't think he thought of these barriers as concrete goals he set for himself. He merely followed the tried and true formula. Fais ce que dois, advienne que pourra. Brackets. Do what you must, and what will be, will be. Close brackets. His whole lifestyle is aptly described in the Book of the Tao, in which the way, not the goal, creates the sense in one's life. These philosophical attempts to make sense of his life would probably have made the professor smile. More than likely, he would have clapped me on the shoulder, looked at his watch and said something like, "There's a FIDE Congress coming up soon." This was a mathematician's view of life, brackets, for he was one, close brackets, an attitude that said, "We needn't be amazed at this world, just live in it," which he did. In May 1981, Irva turned 80. He looked great, tanned, smiling, with a carnation in his buttonhole. Irva accepted congratulations at a reception held in the Amsterdam Carlton Hotel. Little did anyone think that the time to complete his biography, by adding the year of his death to that of his birth, was drawing near. Yet this unfortunate necessity arose just 6 months later, while he had still so many plans. It's a well-known fact that truly healthy people not only don't think about death, but live and act as though they are, in fact, immortal. His pocket set was always set up with positions from the National Correspondence Championship, which he was forever analysing. Irva intended to play in the World Correspondence Championship, a tournament that generally lasts for several years. "Watch me," he told Averbach, 6 months before he died. "I will yet become Correspondence World Champion." He didn't make the slightest concession to his age. He was sure that he would live to be 100. Despite his advanced years, he did not give us a lesson in ageing, and he died not yet full of days. Early in November, Irva set off for Israel on a visit to the Dead Sea. His trip was a difficult one. He flew out of Basel, whence he had arrived from Rotterdam, after a difficult simultaneous exhibition with the night train, and as usual, he hadn't taken a sleeping car. On his second day at the Dead Sea, he suffered a heart attack. When he recovered after a few days, the first thing he asked for was a chest set. The doctors insisted that he stay in the hospital for at least a week. "If the doctors say a week, that means that you can fly home in 2 days," said Irva. Permission was given, but only on condition that, upon returning to Holland, he would put himself immediately into a doctor's care. Upon returning to Amsterdam, he immediately set to work, but the doctors insisted that he be hospitalised, as he needed serious cardiac surgery. He did not lose optimism and hoped to be on his feet again soon. The World Computer Championship was starting, and he had promised to participate. Before the operation, he said, "My greatest desire now is to sit under an apple tree and do nothing. Nothing. Just to sit under an apple tree."
Thank you for listening to this episode of the New in Chess podcast. The New in Chess podcast is published every Friday and can be listened to on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and the New in Chess website. To leave a comment, go to our socials or email us directly at podcast@newinchess.com. We thank our sponsors at DGT for their support and hope to have you back next week for a new episode of the New in Chess podcast.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the New in Chess podcast. The New in Chess podcast can be listened to on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and the New in Chess website. We thank our voice actor, Nick Murphy, our producer, Alex Pollock, and of course our sponsor, DGT, for their support, and hope to have you back soon for a new episode of the New in Chess podcast.